welcome to the Geek Night Inn, episode 31. I'm your host, Laura. I'm here today with my fiance, Rebecca Tilly. Woo, hey, Tilly. Yeah, and Gemma Thompson, who is neither of our fiance.
No, and I don't get an awesome echo either.
Yeah, you don't get like a dual stereo, like, fiance!
No, you get me in mono. That's
we just get you. Yeah. That's not to say we don't love you, but we love each other more because Tilly got me a ring this week. Today, and now I've got a shiny ring on my finger. I told my parents, and now we're getting married.
I think you're most excited about the ring, to be honest. Like, oh, it's so shiny. It's pretty. I love
people
it.
I showed the picture off, and everyone was really impressed with how expensive the £10 ring looked. So I'm like, yeah, I got an expensive ring. Look at how expensive it looks. Sorry, I'm like a magpie. I like shiny stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I got a shiny.
So besides, you know, getting engaged.
Yeah, podcast, geek stuff, things. You got trashed last night, Tilly.
Yes, I made a lot of friends, apparently.
You made a lot of friends by spending more money than you should have on alcohol and...
Yeah, I remember bits of it. And I remember I was with my friend Tony and we were talking and this Italian girl came over. She wanted to find out if Tony was single. And I can't remember how I hijacked the conversation, but I started telling her all about Laura and how I was going to propose today. And Tony was trying to get a word in edgeways, and she was going, oh my god, that's so cute! And I was like, I know, she's so cool, I love her so much, she's so great. And then I invited her to come stay with us, and I showed her pictures of the cat.
And then you came home, and I was like... Let's hope that she never takes you up on that offer because she's not staying with us because she's a weird Italian girl you met while hammered.
I was proper drunk. Like, when I threw up, it was purple. It was great.
That is a mark of a good night out.
Yeah.
It's a mark of a good night out. It's like, I drank so much that I don't remember if I had fun or not, but I don't remember not having fun, so I assume I had fun.
I'm pretty sure I had fun. Like, my friend turned 21, and that's why I was going out. And she was actually only out for about 20 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. She walked me to my hotel, and then we went to the pub to meet Tony and Sean. And then she went to her hotel, and she didn't come back for like an hour and a half. And then she came back, and she, 20 minutes late, she had one drink, and then she was like, yeah, we're going to call it a night, we're going to go back to the hotel. And I was like, okay.
So you booked a hotel room and spent a fortune on alcohol. For how long were you there?
I was there till 3 o'clock in the morning.
Who were you? So wait, Kate went home at what time?
I think she went home just after midnight.
And you stayed out with Tony and...
Just Tony.
You stayed out with Tony till 3 in the morning.
I think Tony wanted to go home, but I was like, no, I've bought all this alcohol, I'm going to drink it, and then we can go home.
Sounds like you had a fun night.
Yeah, he was really sweet. He took me home, and then like the first thing I noticed this morning was he'd hung my coat up for me to dry. Aww.
So, things I did this week. I'm going to start talking about nerdy media stuff, so... I started watching a show that I don't think I should have started watching because I went in knowing that it ends terribly with a really unsatisfying ending. I started watching Dexter this week. So for anyone that doesn't know, Dexter is a show about a serial killer who murders murderers and who works for the police and is ultimately like forced into trying to solve his own murders. And I started watching it, and it's really good. I very much enjoyed watching it. It reminds me a lot of Death Note in a lot of weird ways, where, like, it is the killer who believes he's killing for the greater good of the world and doesn't mind the eventual consequences of those actions. He feels he's doing the right thing. He is in a battle of wits trying to continue doing what he's doing without getting caught. It feels a lot like Death Note in the way it's set up, except for instead of writing words in a book, he is slicing people up and strapping them naked to tables and stabbing them a few times and cutting them into bits. But it's interesting. The only problem I have is like, hey, this show is interesting. However, I know full well that every single person who enjoyed that show was hugely disappointed with the ending. So I'm walking into a lost situation. It's like walking into Lost now and being like, I know that no one liked the ending, but I'm still going to give it a go.
Yeah, I'm at that point with, like, I'd always been kind of intrigued to know what people were talking about with Lost, but once I heard about the utter disappointment in its ending, I've just vowed never to bother.
My thoughts on Lost is, like, Lost is worth watching for the journey that you take. Like, it is, there are some fantastic episodes, and I am still glad that I invested that time into watching it. And knowing that it ends terribly, like, if you go in knowing that, I'm sure the ending's not as disappointing as, like, it was to me, because, like, if you go in knowing that the ending's terrible, you will probably be able to enjoy the journey for what it is.
Okay, yeah.
But I'm
hoping...
that
I wouldn't be able to draw my husband back into watching it, though. He was just, like, just, no, table flip.
Yeah. I am hoping that, like... I'm hoping that just knowing that the ending of Dexter is disappointing will be enough to temper my expectations for the ending in such a way that I'm not as disappointed as other people were at the time. I'm hoping that's the case. We'll see.
Hmm.
But yeah, did you have anything you wanted to talk about? You had something about visiting something in Stockholm this week?
Yes, I've actually ended up doing quite a lot of geeky things this week for this past couple of weeks, but it's kind of been overshadowed by what I did today because I finally visited Spårvägsmuseet, which is Stockholm's tram museum, but it also incorporates public transport.
That's a thing that you like. You like public transport and trams.
Yes, and I kind of expected I'd be excited, but still, when I walked into the place, I was quite giddy, and my husband just, like, had to take a step back and leave me to it, because it's full of buses and trains, and there's a gift shop with Tunnelbana t-shirts and all this
stuff. How much did you end up spending in the gift shop?
Actually, we were quite good, because... in the end, a lot of it didn't quite appeal to us, but we did pick up a book which features a whole load of photography of the artworks on the Tunnelbana. So we've got that as kind of like a coffee table book to sit alongside my book about Harry Beck's London Underground diagrams. So that'll be something that's like, if the time comes we leave Stockholm, we could just revisit the Tunnelbana with this. But I got that and also a badge for my collection because I collect badges mostly from gigs, but Tunnelbana's good as well.
Yeah, that's really neat. There
was another thing. Oh yeah, it was a poster. That was it. Yeah, I've got an A3 poster of the Stockholm Railway Network diagram now. So when people come into my flat, they'll be able to look up how to get their train home.
Oh, that's cool. Well, bless.
It's a bit more useful than the Metropolitan Line diagram I've got hung up in the kitchen at the moment. Which shows you like the various like fast train services on the stretch between like I think it's Wembley and somewhere else up the line.
That's not very helpful considering you live in Sweden.
Indeed, yeah.
How often do you go to Wembley?
I think I've still only been to Wembley once, and even then that was on the Bakerloo line, so yeah.
I have a slight side story from like your direction of the world. So I ate some sweets from Finland.
What was it? Salt lacrits?
Salmiakki.
Oh, okay.
I have no idea what that is. The same thing. It's salted licorice that tastes like licorice dunked in like super salty Play-Doh.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is salt lacrits. Yeah.
Why is that a thing anyone would want to eat?
Well, it's kind of like a Marmite situation. And for anyone who's not encountered it yet, I mean, we're saying salt licorice. It is seriously strong salt. Yeah. It's
licorice.
It's like eating the sea.
It's like licorice that was dunked in like a thin layer of Play-Doh and then just like dipped in salt. So the salt was all stuck to it. It feels like there is literally like a coating of salt around this piece of licorice.
When I was little, I used to eat Play-Doh. So I think that sounds like something I would like.
Yeah, it's Play-Doh with an extra, like, a spoonful extra salt added in.
Good, I like salt.
It's worth saying, though, there are a lot of different varieties. I mean, I can only speak for Sweden, but a while ago I took a vine because I knew I was travelling back to the UK. So I actually took a vine looking down the sweets aisle in a Sainsbury's, and I found one bag of licorice, just plain licorice. Mm. In Sweden, you'll get a couple of aisles of sweets and basically one of them will be devoted to licorice of all sorts.
Oh,
not all of them are salted, because you also get things like licorice cables. They're a Swedish thing. I never knew.
Well, the other thing I tried is Lijona, Lijona, which
Lijona.
I don't know. They look like fruit pastels. They look like jelly tots that have been left out in the sun until they've like shriveled up and become really hard and small, and they're black, and they taste like the smell of deep heat cream.
That also sounds good to me.
They were weird.
They do appeal to a certain type of person, though, because I know for a fact that there's a friend that I bring over salt licorice for. It's a hangover cure, apparently.
Oh, we could have done with that for you today.
It's fine, I just slept.
Slept in the living room all afternoon. You just the sofa in the living room was a bed, and you're like... Wah.
Well, apparently salt licorice is good for recovery from that, so...
Oh, good.
I will have to get a hold of some and keep it round for next time Tilly gets off her face.
Well, I can try to import some for you. It's very cheap and widely available here.
I would very happily have some just to introduce Tilly to what it was.
Well, if you come to Ladycade, I can bring you salt licorice.
I'm going to come to Ladycade. It's on my list of things that I'm actually going to attend.
Woo!
I can't come to Ladycade, but Laura can pick it up for me. And I'll, like, draw a little picture of myself and you can stick it next. You can stick it there.
Speaking on that vague topic, Gemma, do you want to pitch your Patreon you have now?
Oh, well, actually, I was going to mention, because I don't think I've mentioned Ladycade yet. So, like, I've done it before on this podcast. So, yeah. I probably
so do both it. Do your self-promotion stuff, because you're doing really cool things at the moment.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, that's been weird for me. Yeah, Ladycade, which I've mentioned before, is a gaming social which is positive, inclusive to women. All genders are invited and welcome, but it's mainly to allow space for women who make and enjoy games to hang out and be sociable. And it's coming back to London on the 23rd of March.
Hooray, it's coming to a place I can get to.
Yeah, it's in Loading Bar in Dalston, and you can find information at ladycade.org. As part of that, we've launched a fundraising scheme. So you can, it's still free to attend, and there are tickets available through Eventbrite if you want them, just as kind of like a, so we can keep track of numbers. But there's also an option to donate, because we would like to get some like posters and things to spruce up the events a little bit and spread the message. So, I'm thrilled to say some people have already donated, but nobody should feel obliged, but it's part of an overall rolling fundraising scheme we basically want to do. Let's try and snazz up our little women game socials.
You've got your own personal one as well now for like, hey, I do stuff for diversity in games.
Yeah, I should say this is separate, because the Ladycade thing is just for like Ladycade promotional materials and things. But yes, I launched a Patreon this morning at the point of recording, actually. Yeah, basically just to try and make some more permanent resources, because I do a lot of stuff with, there's Ladycade, but things I've not mentioned on the podcast before, like I teach girls and women how to code for the first time here in Stockholm, which is something we're looking to spread across Sweden and generate resources from so that other groups can do this. I also run accessible and inclusive game jams like Global Game Jam. I think I've probably spoken about that before. And the podcast I tried to mention. I'm basically trying to do it through that, because a podcast is a lot of work, as I'm sure you can attest.
Oh, yeah, they are.
I'm just trying to get some funds in to try and do that a bit more easily.
Where can people find that one?
Oh, of course, yes. That's at patreon.com/raygungoth. So use my Twitter handle.
I'm already backing it, so you should all go back it too, because I only back cool stuff.
Yay, thank you.
Woo!
I'd love to be able to be rich and throw money at everything, but unfortunately I can't. So I'm basically just trying to move this along. And as I explain in the Patreon, I explain what I'm trying to do and why and things. So, that's a thing.
Woo, yeah, you're doing stuff. Do we have anything else we want to talk about this week? Who's got things?
Karen Maitland.
What about Karen Maitland?
The book.
continue to say some words. You've got to give us a bit more than that. She's got a plastic jug full of mayonnaise and pasta that she's stuffing her face with. It's like, get the pasta out your face and tell us about
carrots. And because I've been chewing my nails and they taste disgusting because of the, I'm trying to stop chewing my nails. So I'm just trying to shove pasta in my face because I've got chemicals in my mouth now. Ow, stop hitting me. So there's an author called Karen Maitland, because I don't think I've talked about books in a while.
That
I'm finding I'm really enjoying, because I have a sort of, I like, what's the word? I like historical fiction, but I'm very particular about where in history I like it. And my personal preference is right back in the Dark Ages. So, like, 1066. I think up to Tudor times. I don't really like the Tudors. But Karen Maitland, she writes... they're all set in the same... And she pulls in really... She pulls really...
So try that again from the start.
Thank you. She relies quite heavily on old superstitions and things like that. Like the first book of hers I read was called Company of Liars, and it's set in 1200 and something. Basically, when the first plague hits England, and it's about this group of people, and all of them have a lie that they're talking about. Not talking about, but they've lied about something important. Well, important in the context of the time. Like, one of them's Jewish, and one of them's gay, and one of them's a woman. But, yeah, there's this weird force that's killing them, and they're trying not to also get killed by the plague. But I read The Gallows Curse this week, which is, oh my god, I'm boring myself. Holy shit.
It's fine, keep going.
I just can't make a sentence. I'm really sorry.
Like, that's fine, you're hungover, no one blames
you. I'm trying to, like, this book is really cool. I really loved this book, and I'm making it sound like the most boring fucking thing. It's set during the Crusades, or just after the Crusades, and basically this girl gets cursed because she tells someone she's a virgin and she's actually not, and they need a virgin for this spell to work. And so because she lies about being a virgin, her family and her descendants get cursed, and it's about her trying to lift that curse and stuff. And it's very good. Like, it's very complicated. It took a long time for me to get into it because there's such a big cast of characters and things like that. It's one of those ones I was really sad to finish it, because I was like, I'm glad I know what happens, but also I don't want to stop reading it.
Oh.
I'm actually intrigued by historical fiction, because I think I've only ever read like fantasy and cyberpunk and science fiction in the realm of fantasy. I actually can't imagine a book set in a real time. How does it actually work? I think talking as somebody who particularly engages with books with rich worlds in them, like, I'm intrigued to see how historical...
The Earth is a rich world.
Yeah, but I live in it, so it seems boring.
Do you live in 1066? No, you don't. The world of 1066 is a very different place to the Earth of today. Some might even say it's like a fantasy, how different it is.
Ooh.
Oh, fantasy fiction and historical fiction burn.
I'm not getting at the genre. I'm just genuinely intrigued to see how it does it. So I was wondering...
The way Karen Maitland does it is she ties into a lot of superstitions and things like that. So when they believed in, like... herbs that would cure you and stuff. That is the world that she's writing in. And all of that is true, like it's medical truth.
It's the accepted way.
No, it's not the accepted way. It's like fact in that they're right. Does that make sense?
Okay, so it's grounded in
so
like
if they cast a spell on someone, that spell actually takes place.
Okay, so it's,
as opposed to them being like, "Oh, I curse you," and then everyone being like, "Oh," and nothing actually happens.
So it's grounded basically as in like, let's say that they were right in what in the, that their scientific theories were correct.
Yeah, so and, like bad smells cause the plague and things like that.
Okay,
that's a really
that is an interesting take. Yeah,
it is quite good. Next one I have to read is Owl Killers.
Oh, that sounds grim.
Yeah, don't kill the owls. They're lovely.
Company of Liars scared me really bad. That book had to go in the tumble dryer.
That's where she puts books that scare her to make sure they can't hurt her. She puts them in the tumble dryer. Or the freezer.
No.
Wasn't it you that put them in the freezer?
I did put, what's it called? The Lovely Bones. I put that in the freezer. But then there are some books. I think The Lovely Bones made me really sad, so I put it in the freezer so I'd stop thinking about it. Whereas Company of Liars scared me, so that had to go in the tumble dryer.
There's a logic to it.
And The Book Thief, I think that was what I read when we first started podcasting. Like, I think the very first podcast we did, I was reading The Book Thief. Hmm. Or one of the very first ones. That one had to go in the tumble dryer as well. But that's because the freezer wasn't big enough.
Well, I could recommend a book I read recently, which is just like wholly endearing.
Oh, yeah.
Again, it's a comic, considering it's another one from Celia Tekkert. Amongst all the lot I've managed to get through this week is Mouse Guard, Legends of the Guard. Have either of you come across this world before?
No, no, never.
As far as I can tell, it's a comic which then became a tabletop RPG, but I'd only encountered the tabletop RPG before. Never played it, but I've heard it recommended from a number of people. It's a world in which the mice are the protagonists, and they inhabit a vaguely pre-medieval sort of kind of Lord of the Rings Hobbiton sort of world, where the protagonists tend to be members of the Mouse Guard, which is a group of dedicated volunteers who guard the lands between mouse cities and villages, usually keeping predators at bay, because, of course, there's quite a lot of stuff which wants to eat mice. But in this world, there's all these rich folk tales and adventures and things to be had. And Legends of the Guard, ends up discovering, it's my first entrance really into this world. And I would thoroughly recommend it as an entry point, because it's set around a particular tavern in one of these mouse cities, and the innkeeper, barmaid, whatever, is holding a contest to basically she'll write off a patron's bill if they tell the best adventure story she's never heard before.
I've heard the tabletop game of this, where you've got to sort of come up with these fantastical stories to tell to try and outdo each other's stories.
Okay.
I think I've heard of the tabletop game.
I think this is where the comics I've now fed back and like incorporated some of the tabletop premise then. And what we get is like it's basically an excuse for guest artists to inject their bit into the world. But all throughout this, I mean, it's written and drawn by the same guy, I think, who has a gorgeous style. It's really friendly children-style illustration, like proper illustration stuff. And some of the stories in this go into like medieval-style illuminations and things like that.
Oh, wow.
It's a rather wonderful book, yeah.
I can't read books about mice because I read one once that destroyed me.
What was it?
I can't remember what it was called. But I know at the end the main mouse died.
What's this one you've been reading called?
Mouse Guard, Legends of the Guard. Volume 1.
Yeah.
It's not that one. But basically the colony was being destroyed and they had to find somewhere else to live. And there was this mouse that had, it was blind in one eye and he was really tiny, but he got chosen by like the mouse god to lead them, and he led them through like all this stuff. Like, I can't remember what happened. I just remember crying at the end. I just remember getting into the bath and just howling. Because after everything he'd been through, and he sat there looking at his, you know, his little kingdom with his subjects, and he's like, oh, I'm so glad that everyone's happy and everyone's okay and everything's great. And then he gets shot by two random humans, and I was like, ah! Another one had to go in the tumble dryer. Oh, that was before I'd had that system, though, so it stayed in my room looking at me and I couldn't sleep.
Wasn't there one book you hid behind, like, the back of something where you couldn't reach it?
No, that was my essay where I got really bad marks on it.
Oh, you hid the essay behind the cupboard. It's like, I can't reach it, so it doesn't exist.
I got, like, 22% on the essay or something. And it just, like, it made me so depressed. I just couldn't stand having it in the room. I didn't want to throw it away, so I just put it behind the wardrobe.
I love that concept of just, like, the epitome of out of sight, out of mind.
Well,
I think it's safe to say Mouse Guard wouldn't qualify for the tumble dryer. It's a weird one because I think it embodies a lot of what's good about classic children's tales, but I don't mean for it to sound like it's a childish book. It's anything but. It's just written in that style where mice do deal with some vaguely dark, kind of momentous things, but they come through and they have their honour and their society and things. And it's good like that. It's really endearing.
There used to be a film, like, I don't know if, do you remember Cartoon Network used to have Cartoon Theatre on Saturday evenings?
Yeah.
There was a film called The Secrets of Nim.
Oh, The Secrets of Nim!
I've heard of this, and this is ringing a vague bell.
The Secret of Nim is fantastic and heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, it's got a sequel, which is not quite as good.
It's still decent, the sequel.
But it's based on a book called Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. And Nim is spelled N-I-M-H, and it stands for National Institute of Mental Health. So it's one of these, like, rats and mice were experimented on in this centre. And they became super intelligent. And they made their escape and things, and it's really cool. So I've been meaning to read the book of that for years.
It's on the list.
But it's brilliant. Like, if you've ever got an hour and a bit of spare time, just watch the Secrets of Nim. Because, wow, that's, for a film about mice, it's so moving, it's so powerful.
This is what I find with a lot of anthropomorphized, like, good, again, kind of, they seem like children's tales, they're not, but they're actually still suitable for children in that delicious sort of way. They're suitable for everyone. But just having, like, it be played out by animals means you get that distance. So it's clearly not humans doing all this. They wouldn't have that level of interest. But they can just do so much, and they can pack so much emotion and adventure in. It's all kind of... It's very impressive.
Well, I mean, The Secrets of Nim, like, looking back on it now, I'm really surprised that was on Cartoon Network. You know, it's really dark. Like, the main theme of this film is that she's got the mouse, Mrs. Brisby. Her youngest son is really sick and he's dying. But they live on a farm, and the farmer's trying to plough the fields early, but she can't move her son because if she moves him, he'll die. And it's...
There's a few films like that. Like, I look back at some late 90s, early 2000s, maybe early 90s. Like, the early 90s to the early 2000s, there are some bits of children's animated media that I look back on and think, really? This was for kids? Like, Anastasia. I still watch that and I'm like, there are parts of this that are pretty dark. Like, Rasputin singing about kidnapping someone in the dark of the night and summoning demons to kidnap someone out of their bed and... Oh.
I only saw that once, and it was at a bit of a turning point where I was still just about too young to really grasp what it was doing. And yet I do remember it was a strange one, and coming away from it feeling a bit...
Whoa. There's some creepy and dark subtext to a lot of that film.
Mm.
Like, I go back and watch the song In the Dark of the Night from that, and I'm just like, oh, God, that's creepy.
I don't know. I saw Anastasia when I was in Malta, and it bugged me more than anything else.
Yeah, it's...
Because there's no mystery about whether or not... Because Anastasia was a real person.
Mm.
And there's no mystery about whether or not she died. Or if she escaped or whatever. She was taken down into a cellar and shot when she was 8 years old. And I just find that whole film, like, just quite disrespectful in a way. Like, I don't really know how to explain it. But, you know, it's about a little girl who was murdered. And I just... not really a fan.
That's one of those things. I never knew that about that it was based on someone real watching it, and as such, like, I'm able to sort of see that narrative for what it is without the, like when I watch that, I see the narrative that they placed out rather than the cultural context that they were sort of, I guess, taking advantage of in some respects. So, like, I can understand the issues, but it doesn't color how I interpret the narrative. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah, that's fine. Because I know
it has to be fine. You're marrying me now. I'm going to keep saying this. Ari, you'll marry me because you're my fiancé.
I'm afraid I must step in at this point and say marriage doesn't win geek arguments.
Yeah, it does. Agree with me on all arguments or I'm taking the ring off.
Okay, I'll have it back then.
No, it's mine.
You'll learn.
It'll be fine.
If you love me, you'll agree with me.
If I love you, I'll agree that it's okay to trivialize the murder of a young girl.
Yes. Because love.
You might have to specify that in the vows, to be honest. That's so contentious.
You wonder why I'm writing my own vows, because
you're not writing your own vows.
I'm going to now, so I can put this in.
Oh, God. I feel like we could put that out to vote, actually, like... geek wedding vows. What should be in there?
Oh, that'd be good. I promise to never compare Star Wars and Star Trek.
This has got me thinking, though. I've just stopped to think we should probably address the fact that Leonard Nimoy died this week.
Oh,
yes.
Shit, yeah.
Yeah. Like, all I could really think to say when I found out this had happened is he lived a long life. He achieved a great many things. He... for me personally, completely changed the way that I see science fiction, and he is a lot of the reason that I developed an interest in sci-fi as a genre. He lived long and he prospered.
I think I was impressed with actually somebody pointed out how much of a good male role model as well, because he was a fundamentally empathetic individual. And I'd actually encountered a few instances of his photography work, which often dealt with body image and identity in an interesting way, I thought. Generally, it's in a feminist way, I think.
Yeah. Well, he's very interesting in that, like, the obvious thing that people always go to is his performance of Spock. And, like, for me, his performance of Spock was really instrumental to me in my early teens. I don't talk about this much, but, like, as someone who... didn't always see the world the same way everyone else did, in terms of, like, I have Asperger's syndrome and there are certain aspects where I just don't line up with other people. And he's a little bit of a caricature almost of it, but, like, his performance as Spock made it feel a bit more okay to not interpret the world through the same lens as everyone else.
Mm.
And that was, like, a really interesting, that was a really important thing for me in terms of media. So I will always thank him for that.
Mm.
And my goodness, someone... I think the thing that made it hit home is someone sent me a piece of footage. I believe it was from one of the Star Trek films. I forget which one now, but it's the one where Spock dies and there is a funeral scene for Spock.
Mm.
And that scene, watching that this week, was very, very, very touching.
I think the one that got me actually was, I assume it was one of the astronauts above the ISS had posted a picture of them doing the Vulcan salute with Earth in the background.
Oh, there's a few of those. Like, IGN of all places did a really touching one where they had a huge number of people who work in their offices, just one after the other doing the Vulcan salute.
Mm.
And it's that got me.
I think Star Trek is just it's like a hotbed for good role models, essentially. Mm. I mean, Leonard Nimoy, we've already talked about what he's done as Spock and what he's done as a person. Patrick Stewart, I haven't watched Next Generation, but Patrick Stewart, I know, is he donates a lot of money and time to mental health charities and to women's shelters and things like that. Mm. And there just seems to be something that is just fundamentally good about Star Trek.
Well, the wonderful thing about Star Trek as like an ongoing running sci-fi series, particularly in the time that the original series started, is that while there are still some issues with it, if you look back at it now from today's perspective, if you compare it to any other piece of media on television at the time that it released, it was pushing a lot of boundaries. And just by virtue of being a relatively mainstream show that had the level of abstraction of being a sci-fi series set in a different time period in space, it was able to sidestep a lot of issues that in a grounded show on Earth in the present day would have been considered contentious things to push.
Mm.
It used its level of abstraction to push a lot of boundaries and to do a lot of good.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to Gene Roddenberry's perspective, which, as expressed through Star Trek, is basically like we're 100 years in the future and humanity is out amongst the stars. Of course we've fixed things like discrimination and capitalism and like capital greed, mostly, I suppose, and things like that. And then, of course, actually, like, somewhat falling back to what I was saying about when you anthropomorphize characters, just being able to remove that. Because, as I think, Will Wheaton's written about this a few times, again, just keeping in the Star Trek and awesome people thing. He's written about the fact science fiction can deal with issues at a remove. And even in a way which sometimes people watching the thing might not be consciously aware of what's going on. But then if they then apply that context to real life, they suddenly realize, oh.
Well, that's, I think, what was so great about it is that it snuck a lot of very positive values into a piece of media in such a way that people didn't even realize their values were being shaped in a new positive light. And like Leonard Nimoy was a huge part of that. And I don't know. It's one of those things, like, it didn't necessarily surprise me that at his age, after his health conditions, that it had happened. But it is still a very sad day to know that, like, the world is a lesser place without him, I feel.
Yeah.
The world seems slightly smaller now.
Yeah. And it's very sad.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Anyway, do we have anything else we want to talk about this week?
Broadchurch.
Oh, Broadchurch. Okay.
And lesbians.
Yeah, Broadchurch and lesbians. Okay, so
Broadchurch has lesbians in it.
Shut up. Don't. I was going to do a spoiler tag.
Sorry.
Broadchurch. Okay, spoiler tag. Broadchurch has some lesbians in it. Okay, that's done. So me and Tilly watched.
It's so well. Sorry.
Let me get there.
I'm so excited.
We'll talk about Broadchurch as a general series. Then we will hone in on a specific and we'll put on like a little spoiler tag thing so you can talk about it. Okay.
We have to.
Yes. Cause this is how podcasts work.
And I just talk about it.
No, I've got to be the master here of the format and stuff. So Broadchurch's second series is really interesting. For anyone that doesn't know Broadchurch, it is a British series on ITV that follows a small town on the coastline where there has been a murder. And the entire first series is about trying to find out who's committed this murder. And it ends this first series of, okay, this man is the murderer. This is how he did it. He has confessed. We've got a lot of the emotional fallout of the town. Season over. And they made a really fascinating decision with the second season to basically have this person who we had seen commit the murder, admit to the murder, we knew he was the murderer, get taken to trial, and go up on the stand and say not guilty and watch an entire season of a court case in which everyone from like everyone in the town and all of the viewers know this man is guilty, but you suddenly start to see all these flaws in how the investigation in season one was handled. All these things that at the time in season one you were really rooting for, like the wife of the murderer, like when she finds out that he committed the murder, she goes into the police holding cell and she beats him up because she's like, how could you do this? And then in season two, like they use that, like the defense for this man, use that against them. It's like, you say you got a confession, but that same day you were allowed by the police into a holding cell to attack this man. Who's to say that he didn't confess because of your attack on him? And like, they start pulling apart the entire first season and saying, you know, like the viewers and the village all know that this man is the killer for certain. But the case, like, you get to watch, like, this fighting back and forth trying to prove it. It was really interesting to me. It in many ways, made me think a lot about Serial, the podcast about a genuine murder case. There were a lot of places that it drew some interesting parallels there. And it was a really interesting decision for how to handle this second series. So we watched through most of it in one day. You've gone quiet. Is that because I won't let you talk about the thing?
I'm concentrating. Carry on.
She's scraping nails stuff off her nails. So, yeah, the second season, it was a very bold decision to go with. It was a little inconsistent at times, but it was a fascinating decision to have a season of like a murder mystery show end with the killer being caught and admitting their guilt. And then, like, the second season was in some ways anticlimactic and unrewarding, but in a way that, like, to me at least, felt like a deliberate mirroring of, like, the way that the characters in the show felt about this whole trial. That, like, a murder trial is not something that is clean-cut, that people walk away from feeling a sense of accomplishment. It is something draining, it is something unrewarding, and they did a really good job of paralleling that in the way they set up the show. Now, Tilly.
Lesbians!
Okay, we're going to do a spoiler tag. There are some lesbians in the show, so skip ahead, let's say, 3 minutes if you don't want to hear about these particular lesbians. So it's not a huge plot spoiler, but if you don't want to know who the lesbians are, skip ahead like 3 minutes. Go.
Yeah, it's not, it's so well represented, like, it's not, it's not so much, like, a twist or anything. Like, it's the lawyer for the prosecution, she talks to David Tennant's character a little bit, and they talk about having children, and he says, have you ever had kids? And she says, no, I never got married. And he's like, oh, right, you know, was that, you didn't want to? And she was like, no, like, there was a time once, but the moment's passed or something like that. And you don't really think anything more of it. But they show this, like, this friendship between her and this other woman about her age who is also single.
They're both in their, like, 70s, I would guess. What 50s. Was that said? 50s. Okay, they're, like, let's even on 60s.
50s.
Okay, fine. They're older ladies.
Yes, they are older lesbian ladies. Okay, so they're not necessarily lesbians, but they're at least bisexual. And, yeah, it's really cool because there's, you know, there's just the one is looking after the other all the time and they're always talking and they know each other really well. And from, like, 3 episodes in, I was going, yeah, they're gay. They're totes gay. They are. They just are. And then they kissed and I was like, what?
But it was so subtle.
But it was on the screen. Like, it wasn't, like, implied or anything. It wasn't they weren't just like, what did she say? It was something like, oh, you're gonna make me say it, aren't you? I'm in love with you. And she's like, you think I didn't know that? And then they kiss and it's like, what? It's like,
you think I didn't know that, but surely it's a bit late for, like, what do you want me to do about this now? It's like, who says it's too late for us to do anything about it? And then they kiss and it's just a really subtle, tender moment between two older ladies. And like, It was in no way, like, the shock wasn't that this woman was coming out as gay. It was, like, why did you wait until we were older ladies to tell me this? Why didn't you tell me this years ago?
And just wonderful. Oh,
it was so great.
It's the way everything they handled it. I wanted from Sherlock and didn't get.
Yeah. So there's that. But anyway, back to the show overall. Like, it was, there were some fantastic performances in its season finale. And, like, I know Tilly came away feeling a bit sort of disappointed and, like, anticlimactic about it all. But
yeah, I mean, I would have liked a bit more focusing on the murderer himself. I think I would have liked to try and see him talk about why he didn't want to go to prison for it. Because that's all the explanation you get, is at the beginning of the series he says, I can't go to prison for this.
Yeah, basically.
And it's like, well, you just killed a kid. So what exactly, like, what is your mindset? Are you, because I just don't see how you can go from, yep, this kid is now dead and it's my fault. This 11-year-old boy is gone. His family's gone through hell. And, you know, I'm the one who did it. To just, I don't want to face up to it. I just want to, because his whole plan isn't to, like, just stay out of prison. He wants to go back to the life he was living before. He wants to move back in with his wife, and he wants to take his kids to school. And it's like, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well,
like, I would have liked to see more explanation from him as to what he was thinking, because I just don't understand.
Well, as I've been trying to say, the basically the first season ends with this man admitting to the murder he's committed, and, like, he admits to it because he's confronted and the facts are there, and he knows, like, it's obvious I did it. He's not a lawyer. He doesn't know the loopholes required to get around it. He just knows, I've been caught. I don't have a choice about facing it. And then once he starts talking to lawyers, it's this very much like...
No, but he gave himself up.
Let me.
Well, no, because you're making the wrong point. He gave himself up at the end of the first series.
Yes, because he got cornered with the evidence and he knew he was going to get captured, so he gave himself up.
No, because he's the one who turned the phone on in the first place that led to them finding him. And he was just like, oh, I'm fed up of running anymore. And I said to you at the time when we watched it, that feels really disappointing to me, in that they didn't find out who did it because of any, like, great detective work or anything. They just found out who he did it because he decided he was tired of lying.
Okay. Well, the point I was trying to make was that the second season starts with him, like, once he starts talking to lawyers, it's basically the way I felt it was presented was, this man has been faced with the realities of life in prison, and he's suddenly got scared. Like, as much as he wanted to not face up to it, and he wanted to get it out in the open and be like, right, I don't have to hide what's happened now, it's a very different thing to suddenly have to, like, take away that moment of, like, his snap decision to come forward, and, like, having to stop and take a minute to face the realities of life in prison. He suddenly got cold feet and was like, I cannot do that. And he panicked and backed out. And the whole season is basically just him not saying a word, because it's like, he can't do any, like, he knows that everyone in that room knows he committed murder. He can't do anything to get around that fact. Like, anything he says is just going to infuriate everyone. All he does is he just sits there and hopes it's all going to go away. He buries his head in the sand and
lets his lawyers do all the fighting for him.
Yeah, he lets the lawyers do the fighting for him, and he just sits back in the hopes of, if I do nothing, I can get away, and if I'm found innocent, everything will be fine. And he just seems a little bit emotionally numb, and, like, he never gives... Here's the thing, it's like, if he doesn't say anything, no one can fight him directly. And that means he is free of that, but it means that everyone else is left completely unable to have their moment of venting at him. Which I think was an interesting decision. It was frustrating for viewers, but it was equally frustrating for the characters. And I really liked that duplicity of the cast feeling as irritated by this character as the viewers would be. But yeah, I'm glad we watched the second season. I'm excited for season three.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. It was very interesting.
Well, it certainly sounds heavy when I've got no response to it, because that is interesting, but also, whoa.
Okay, well,
yeah, it's really heavy. It's well, I'm sad now.
we've got a few more minutes left. Gemma, have you got anything else you'd like to talk about before we wrap up?
Well, I kind of ended up doing little bits of things. I suppose the biggest thing for me personally is having finally started watching Father Ted.
Is this your first time ever watching Father Ted?
It was my first time watching Father Ted, and the first episode, I was in hysterics.
Which is the funny. First episode?
I'm struggling to remember, so I'm just going to look it up on Wikipedia now.
Father Ted.
Today's episode was Song for Europe.
The Lovely Horse.
Lovely Horse.
Yeah. I love that episode. Oh, Father Ted is just
the
genius.
Only thing going through my head right now is these horses are very small, but the ones out there are far away.
Yeah. I had no idea that was a Father Ted thing, and this has happened a few times. The one I did know was a Father Ted thing was Down With This Sort Of Thing.
Yeah,
when they're protesting the film. That episode was super. That had him in hysterics.
There is a fantastic episode with Graham Norton in it that I absolutely love.
There's several
love.
Of Graham Norton.
Okay,
yeah, he's in
the
Hell.
One in the very small caravan.
Yeah, that's Hell.
Yeah.
That's one I've seen, yeah.
It's great. That episode... moment where they're like, oh, it's not time for his bath, is it? No, he had his bath in January. Calm down.
The first episode was Good Luck, Father Ted. It's the one where a TV program offers to interview him, and they have the fun fair going on Craggy Island.
That one's good.
And the fun fair is like, they've got the cat spinning on the record player, and the what was it, the Swamp of Doom, which has got like an inflatable alligator in it.
And
a park bench being lifted up on a crane.
Oh, don't they accidentally interview Father Dougal?
Yes, they accidentally interview Dougal. It's just... Oh, it's perfect.
Father Ted is so worth watching.
Yeah.
It is one of those fantastic, late 90s British comedies where it's like, yep, this will stand the test of time.
Well, you say British, wonderful. But the Graham Linehan is Irish, but I think it was banned from being shown in Ireland or something. Because it's very, anti-Catholic.
They poke a lot of fun at Catholicism in Father Ted, and it just wonderful.
Given that Father Dougal, who is played by Ardal O'Hanlon, brilliantly.
He has
this whole thing. One of the recurring things about him is that he doesn't actually, nobody knows why he's a priest. So he's asked, he'll come up with stuff he doesn't really believe in heaven and hell and that sort of thing. He thinks it's ridiculous. It's nonsense.
Yeah. It's like that heaven and hell thing. And he's like, you mean the Bible?
Wonderful.
So I'm
loving
Song
that.
For Europe is fucking amazing. I just love Song for Europe. I sing the shitty version all the time.
Sing it.
My lovely horse running through the field. Where are you going with your fetlocks blowing in the wind? I love it. It's great.
Aww. I also love that that Neil Hannon was involved in doing the dream version, the music video.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because I rather like Neil Hannon. He's one of my favourite songwriters. Fine comedy.
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
And with that, that's probably a good place to start wrapping up for this week. So it's been a really good week this week. I've enjoyed this. So we should probably do self-promotion. So Gemma, where can people find you on the internet?
They can find me at RaygunGoth on Twitter and on Patreon.
My lovely, wonderful, amazing fiancé, Tilly, where can we find you on the internet? Sorry, I'm excited that she's my fiancé.
It's at Gathering Tilly on Twitter and valencekiller.wordpress.com. .com
yeah.
is my blog.
And you can find me at Twitter at Indie. Shut up. You can find me on Twitter at Laura K. Buzz. You can find all of my podcasts by searching on iTunes for Laura K. Buzz. And you can find me on Patreon at Laura K. Buzz. I am, let me find out one second. I am about $18 away from hitting $1,000 a month. So, woo! Yeah, so thank you very much for listening this week, and we will have another episode for you again next week. Bye.
Bye.
Aww.